few seconds.
All right.
And I think we are live. Hi, Jeremy. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. How about you?
I'm doing great as well. I'm really happy to see all the talk that we're having. And I was
Yeah.
particularly excited when I got your proposal for this talk because mentoring, as I was telling you during the check-in process, is a subject dear to my heart. So I'm really excited, not only for the talk that you've just done, but also for the question that people are going to ask you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to answering some questions. Mentoring is also something near and dear. Something I did not mention is when folks would ask me, like, what was your most important class? Or I said, oh, easy, 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 high school English. Like, it's my whatever your primary written and spoken language is, I think is the most useful skill as a programmer.
Right. So as usual, people, if you want to ask questions to Jeremy, feel free to find the link to the other pad either on the talk page or on IRC. We're also going to open the chat so that people can join us and ask questions. Let me just make sure that I tell Sasha, can you open ID Mentor? All right. So in the meantime, what we'll do is that I'll be reading question of the pad and Jeremy will be answering them whilst we wait for you to join. Now, just to be clear with the time, we have a little bit of time now, a little more time than before. We have 22 minutes, so until 10 of the next hours to answer as
Okay.
many questions as possible. And believe me, if you people watching right now are not asking questions, I will be asking plenty of them. So please,
Great.
save Jeremy from my inquisitive mind.
Oh, I look forward to it. So.
All right. Starting with the first question, a very trivial one, perhaps, but always one that I ask myself when I look at a keyboard. Regarding the super key, which key do you bind to super?
So my left command, which is on on a Mac keyboard, so the key right to the left of the space bar is super. And the key immediately to the right of space bar, which is the right command key, is bound to hyper, which opens up a whole new suite of keys. And I thought it would take a little bit to get used to, but it's been amazing. So I definitely recommend having a hyper binding.
I will, yes. I was also going to say super binding. No, it's a hyper binding. We already have super. It's your Windows key or your Linux key or whatever you want to call it. But I will warn people though. It's the gateway, whatever, into fancy keyboard setups because it's the Trojan horse of fancy keyboard setup. Just, oh, I wish I could have another modifier, and then many years later, you find yourself with this little thing that I'm showing, which is a fully customized QMK keyboard. All
Oh
right.
yeah.
We'll keep
Oh
this for later.
yeah, and following on that, then meta is to the left of super, and then control is to the left of meta, and also caps lock maps to control as well. Definitely tried a bunch of like tap for this and that on a programmable keyboard, but I have settled on keep it simple and use something like carabiner elements to do most of the mapping.
Right. It's good that you were able to stop there. I wish I'd stopped there at some point in my life.
It was a terrible moment where I'm like, oh, what have I done when I was trying to type once? So yeah, it's great.
All right. Well, moving on to the next question. Great talk. What's the package you use to make the org slide?
Yeah, so I am using Prot's is that Logos, and have I think like Olivet mode. I'll post a link to the configuration for turning it on and off, but it's basically narrow region to an org heading, which is I find that to be super helpful. Don't have to fiddle with it.
Right, just to be clear, it's Olivetti, right? I think that's
Oh
the
yeah, Olivetti,
word. A typical Italian word that is really tough to pronounce between Europeans and people in the US.
yeah, I had a for some reason I dropped the I at the end, so in my head. So, yeah.
Right, moving to the next question. If people do get interested in picking up Emacs because of what they see you do, how do you recommend they get into it?
Oh, yeah. So I've been I think a lot of it comes down to what are the problems that they're trying to solve. And so I walk them through my journey. I worked in TextMate for a long time, then Sublime, then Atom. And then in 2020, I hopped over to Emacs, started writing in it, and I chose SpaceMax, and then I chose Doom. And then I was like, wait, start over, erase everything, and just do the tutorial. So I did the tutorial, and then I started writing, and I was like, oh, I really want this functionality. And so I went and I looked for it, and I installed the package. And then I got the functionality, went back to writing, and I'm like, oh, my editor should really be able to do this. And I thought about it. So a lot of it came down to the experience of what they're trying to accomplish. And really helping ask them that. I had a one mentee, had used Vim for a long time, and then was exploring using Evil Mode and Emacs. And we had conversations, and it was like, go back to Vim. Like, you were using VS Code, just go back to Vim. And they went back to Vim, and then they started writing, well, they went to NeoVim, and they started writing Lua plugins for stuff. And it just helped free them, and they gained that ownership in their text editor. So I try to have them think through what are the common tasks that they're trying to accomplish, and then thinking in terms of that. So instead of going and finding a solution, understand the problems they're experiencing, which tends to be what we should do in software development. Instead of implementing the solve a problem, sometimes it's fun to implement an idea.
Yeah, I think it's really the crux, really, when it comes to software development, because what is at the crux of any kind of engineering? Well, it's the problem you're trying to solve. If you've got two islands and you need to join them up together, well, I need to build a bridge. Now, obviously, with software, we have problems that defy the law of physics, which is great because we get very complex problems that are very exciting to solve. But when it comes to onboarding people into those ways of solving problems, well, I think mentoring, the key behind mentoring is that together, we're going to look at a problem and we're going to try to see how I would fix it. And you're going to try to appreciate whether this is something you would do as well or would like to do.
Yep, absolutely. It's really taking time to walk with them on the journey to understand what's frustrating them. I have a coworker, we've been working together for a very long time. She is not a fast navigator of her editor, but as we've talked, that's not where she's looking to get better. She's looking to get better at asking the questions of the clients early so that we don't go down long paths of implementation. So it's been great because she's not looking to get better at her text editor. She's adequate for how she navigates. Other people look and they're like, man, I want to do it faster. I want to do it different. I want to do it better. And then we have a different conversation.
Right. All right, moving on to the next question. I've been using Emacs for about 30 years, and I find it really difficult to figure out how to help people get started with it. So I guess my question is the same as the green question right above it. I think it's slightly different, though, because
it is. We're
talking more about, well, go on, please interpret. Yeah. However, right.
So my wife a while ago talked about the idea of, relative to anybody, I am an expert or slightly more informed on a topic than the person, quote, behind me. And there's a person ahead of me who's slightly more informed than I am. And so what we're looking at is perhaps with 30 years of experience, introducing someone to Emacs might be difficult because you're too much of an expert. So maybe there's an idea of, like, what are the principles of pedagogy? I know that was talked about yesterday in a presentation about, like, here's a constraint, you're using Emacs for the course. But so it's that idea of sharing what you have, where you're at, will, I think by nature, move the entire queue of people, like they don't really exist. I mean, they do, but they don't. Behind you, it'll help move them together forward just a little bit. And maybe we all move the condition together. So it's not a only one person kind of thing. It's a mindset of improving shared understanding.
Exactly. And this, I'd like to come back on something that you mentioned in your answer, because it's, you know, when the person asking the question mentioned 30 years of advance, basically, on studying Emacs, you know, that's a lot of time. And you tend to equate this to a massive gap in terms of skills between the two people. And whilst it's obvious that would be a gap of skills, you know, I find that learning in terms of pedagogy works best when the person doing the teaching is very close in terms of skill levels to the person being taught. Why is it the case? It's because it's much fresher in their memory what are the different ailments that they have to go through to acquire a particular skill. To go a little bit into the theory, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Vygotsky, or at least the I plus one. Are you familiar with this, Jeremy?
I am not. Go forward. Go it's, on.
So I used to be a teacher before, and it's one of the things they taught us. It's about the fact that when you are trying to make someone acquire a skill, I represents their current knowledge, and plus one is the thing that you should be teaching them. And the theory behind it is that it's much easier to teach something to someone when they only have to focus on plus one, i.e. something that is very close, nearby to them. If you go with something that is I plus two, I plus three, or God forbid, I plus 10, it's going to be much harder for them to get to the understanding because the distance is much greater. And that's why I think mentoring can be taken in two ways. It can be a mentor who's merely ahead of you by plus one, or it could be a mentor that is ahead of you by plus 10, but who has the understanding of what plus one, plus two, and plus three is.
Yeah, and it can be very challenging to unwind that. I know, like, if we think about all of our hands or input methods have a memory of something that I honestly couldn't tell you what it is, right? Like, I know how to do it on a keyboard, right? We've internalized so much. And so, yeah, how to walk backward is a distinct challenge. And being curious with them and close to them and not asking, trying to diffuse questions and not ask, like, leading, not overly leading. An example, early on in my like mentoring career, I was working in a community project and I really wanted to go in and say to everybody, why do we suck at sharing code? But instead I said, wait a minute, what would be the question I could ask the group in which I could then ask my question? So I went into the group and I said, how are we doing about sharing code? And collectively, we were able to establish we didn't feel very good about it. And that conversation now 9 years ago helped move a process along for the last, like it gave it energy for 9 years of how we're sharing and how we're approaching stuff. So yeah, the curious questions are super helpful.
All right, lovely way to finish this point. We have about 10 more minutes, so I'm glad that we have a little bit of extra time to answer the questions because we have a little more. All right, I'm going to switch to the next question. We can come back to people reacting to what you just said a little bit later.
Sure.
All right, have you encountered anyone that are being negative about the fact that you're using Emacs, assuming that they just don't know or have misconceptions about Emacs and nothing malicious? If so, how do you handle these kinds of people?
Sure. So at work, I get a gentle like elbowing of like, oh, Jeremy's going to talk about Emacs again. So it's not entirely, maybe it's a little dismissive, but I don't actually care because like, it's like being, I don't know, it's like being made fun of for using a particular type of pen. My goal is to write something, right? And I'm using a pen that gives me joy. When I talk with my mentees, like, I want to meet them exactly where they're at with their code and like their what they're comfortable with, and help them remove any of that potential like inadequacy, sense of inadequacy or imposter syndrome or any of those things, because the goal is to, for me, to be better at computering. Like, hop on my computer. I want to be able to use it at a speed of thought that doesn't introduce a lot of friction. Another speaker talked about that, using Hyperbole and a couple of plugins to write stream of consciousness. And that was an important consideration. I want my text editor to flow with me. And so I'm like, well, Emacs flows with me smooth. Like, you can deride it all you want. It doesn't thread very well, but it's just me on this machine. I don't need it to overly thread, at least for my use cases.
Yeah, I can only agree 100% with what you've just said. And it's very easy to dismiss stuff like Vim or Emacs based on the very trite sentences that everyone use. But at the end of the day, I really like what you said. It's those are just pencil that we're using to express ourselves. And we're doing something a little more fancy than just, you know, writing words on a page. But ultimately, it's just text at the very bottom. So whatever helps us write this text more easily, you know, it's always good.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to the next question. I love the attitudes and worldview that infuse your blog post and your talk this weekend. Learn something every week. It's cumulative. English class was the most important. What other advice do you have, and how is it generalizable to those of us who are not devs?
Sure. So I think one of the really big changes for me, and I talked about this in the writing Q&A, is switching my blog from a topical one about role-playing games and board games into anything that I think I want to write. And that shift happened about the time that I was really exploring using Emacs for writing. And so previously, I would write blog posts in Markdown or I would write it in the web interface. And getting to the point where my writing was the same as my coding, was the same as my RSS consumption, was the same of a lot of these things, freed up my general interests so that they all can kind of play in that space. So, and that's the, I think Feynman said, like, his notes are his thoughts. It's not him thinking. I mean, they are him thinking as well. So it's really framing it that way. And then for not devs, my daughter has been doing screenwriting, and she just had her school license for the tool that they use for writing screenplays. She had to pay for it on her own. And I was like, hey, let's take a look at Emacs. There's a package for this. Maybe it makes sense to you. So I think the, really to summarize it, is like the broad curiosity in like, I have a liberal arts degree. I have barely any computer science classwork practice. I have a lot of practical experience doing software development, but theory is minimal. Instead, I look to things like Lord of the Rings or role-playing games or poetry or history or whatever, and be curious. And then be playful. The introduction of Git locally, where I can just have a Git repo, means my text is recoverable. I can play. I'll break it. I'll change it. It's software. Let it be soft. It's not hard. It can be hard to work with it, but let it be soft. Let it be pruned. Let it go away. Let it die. Let it come back.
Yeah, that's a lovely attitude to have. I mean, I've already talked about my past as an English major in one of the Emacs Conf talk, but just like you, you know, I don't have a ComSci education. I just started with needing a better pen, and that was about 10 years ago. And now I find myself, you know, hosting Emacs Conf, but, you know, it was a very incremental process, a very cumulative process, to reuse the word that we used before. And yeah. What I also like about people outside of ComSci using Emacs, and we've got plenty of such examples in the conferences, in the presentations we've had this year, but also last year, it's that you get so many different windows into how people are using Emacs. And it kind of harks back to what I was saying before about Emacs being a platform with many horizontal packages permitting any kind of workflow imaginable. And some people are going to gravitate towards org mode. I think it was your sister that you mentioned that was looking into packages for writing screenplays. Well, we've got such a thing in Emacs. I mean, a screenplay is just a monospace font with some fancy formatting. It's not very complicated. Yeah. And if you can get behind, you know, someone using such a stable format for writing screenplay with many rules, but ultimately all the screenplay look the same. Well, Emacs is kind of just the same. It's about standardizing the way you edit text. So I think your sister was already half won on the idea.
Yeah. Oh, it was my daughter. I'm trying to sell her on.
Oh, daughter. Sorry.
Yeah. She also picked up programming just one day and was like, I forget the, like she was playing with a stage manager programming thing or like have little avatars moving around, and so she's got a predisposition to like the craft of things, and I think that's another aspect is like I appreciate science, I'm here for a scientific approach, but I also really enjoy the craft of things, playing with it. Like, this is my playground. I love kind of hacking on it and looking at packages and seeing how I might use it, pick it up for a little bit, and then maybe I forget about it.
Right. Well, Jeremy, yeah. I think that was a lovely finish. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Plasma. Oh, sorry. I thought it was someone on Mumble talking to me. I'm going to have to be sorry because we only have about 50 seconds until we move on to the next talk. But please, Plasma Strike, if you want to ask your question to Jeremy, by all means, stay in the room.
Yep, I'll be here.
And we'll be recording all of this and we'll put this later on the talk page. So, Jeremy, I'll have to say bye now because I need to prepare the next room. But it was lovely talking with you and thank you for all your answers.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
See you.
Hello.
One of the things with Emacs is it's like when you change the file management, you just change very, very small amounts of what exactly you want to change.
Yep.
Like, you go from text editing to your file manager, you're not changing your theme. You're not changing your font.
Mm-hmm.
And you use your bookmarks. You use your bookmarks in your emails. You use your bookmarks in your org mode documents. Yep. Use your email. You use it in EWW buffers if you use that. But it's just the least amount of incremental changes.
Yeah, when you were talking about like the reducing friction, like turn off editing, or not editing, but autocorrect while you're typing, it's absolutely spot on. You're wanting to get whatever is flowing needs to keep flowing. Like as a programmer or as a creative, anytime I can hit flow is my goal. And so paying attention to what removes flow is, or hinders it or saps energy, and that unified environment of Emacs is really helpful to maintain that. So, yeah.
You think it's about speed, and then once after you get some of that, then you're like, well, right. Yeah, it's important, but this is like the last thing I care about.
Right. Speed is like, yeah, there's a quote that I love called, I forget the author. It's, there is a connection between slowness and remembering and fastness and forgetting. And the slowness is an interesting, like, it's, I am moving fast in Emacs because I've forgotten how I'm doing it. I just do it now, right? And then the slowness of like being in my thought and staying on that stream is where I want to be and ride whatever that pathway is. And a text editor is still hard to do that, because if I were using a pen and paper, it's more cumbersome to auto edit, but I can't get it out without like losing my thinking. And so I end up having to type it.
Something I've been experimenting with is using, well, recording. Some other people are using dictation for this to just get the blur out of the ideas. Right. And you can go back and glean some of that stuff out of it.
Yeah, what I will do when I'm capturing like quotes or epigraphs is I will almost always turn on dictation because I got a book in one hand. So I'm like, on goes the typing. And yeah, I'm really thankful that that exists, as well. Like, my mother is blind, and so having that helps her and me communicate through text, because we're both able to appreciate it, and use it in a way that is accessible for both of us.
There's the Elfie 2 package, which will allow you to subscribe to a YouTube channel and then download the subtitles and give mm-hmm. you a remote control access to the MPV player to watch the YouTube thing. And Considering you have a really big subtitle thing that you can click at the various different places, it's really surprising about how different that makes YouTube feel.
Yeah, I've...
And then on top of that, about how much, like, if you've used it, why would you never have thought about that before? Because it's
right.
much better.
Right, absolutely. Sasha?
Oh, I would say, I do use the captions a lot also when I'm skimming through stuff for Emacs News. But for books specifically, I often use Google Lens to just capture the text and copy it.
Yeah.
Just so that I don't have to deal with the recognition errors or whatever.
It's really useful. I started, so one of my hobbies is role-playing games, and the tabular data that is in the role-playing books is never in correct, like, copy it out. And so I was like, this is really annoying. And I ended up taking screenshots on my machine, running Tesseract to pipe it in, and then using Emacs to like edit it, because Tesseract adheres to the column format that I'm looking for. And I'm really thankful that we're at a place where the OCR is in good shape. That's all part of my day job, is working on some old documents that OCR is good, but not great because of their 19th century documents. But having that ability to me is really powerful, because we're going to be able to share that text. And also then, once it's understood in what its ASCII or UTF-8 encoding is, it can be translated as well. So we can make it even more generally available, which I think is a nice thing to have.
I wanted to go back to the topic of mentoring, since that's something that I'm very much interested in figuring out how to facilitate in the Emacs community. Other people have been working on kind of remote mentoring initiatives with Emacs Buddy, and there are meetups as well that kind of get that sense of, like, you know, what people are doing things, and then somebody can look over their shoulder and say, hey, have you ever thought about this?
Right.
If there are any things that you can suggest specifically in the context of this kind of mentoring over a distance, any chance you've thought about it?
I'm on the Emacs Buddy repo, and I've had a handful of people reach out to me. Most often we start with email, and every so often it'll be like, hey, let's hop on some kind of video or audio. Even just on phone calls. I haven't done any of the, like, shared buffer stuff. I know, like, at work we have Replit, where we can use that. Seeing the presentation on CDRT, I was like, oh, that's really great. But what I've found is being able to see someone, I don't get to see them typing, but I get to see the results of what they're doing on the computer. You know, paying attention to that is the big one, to help them think of a different way. Depending on where they're at when they're writing, if they are, like, at a pause point, if I'm at my best, I'll be like, so what are you thinking? Where are you stuck? Because maybe they're trying to navigate somewhere, and that starts to create a point for a conversation of, like, how do I go from here to there? And so it's looking for those moments is where I try to operate.
And sometimes, you know, so there's kind of like, how do you go from here to there? And sometimes even the what there should I be going for is a main challenge, right? Because especially with Emacs newbies, they might not necessarily know what's possible or what's nearby in terms of what their current knowledge is. And that's an interesting thing to map out. Is that something that you've thought about, and, you know, as you're conversing with all these people?
The main thing there, the main function that I do talk, I talked about this, I think, in the talk, where it's, I need to jump between the test and the implementation. And since 2005, I've had that. And I watch folks not have that. And I'm just like, oh my goodness, like, there's a convention in the language we work in. Let's get that installed. Let's get it going. Like, that's one thing. That's one axis I know they're going to go to. Another one is the jump to definition. And I've never gotten, like, C tags. I haven't really spent time on that. But with the advent of LSP, it works a lot better. And so I try to get people to use that. And what I've noticed, weirdly, is, like, VS Code, it doesn't work as well as I would have thought. And there's lots of, like, errors and warnings popping up in the bottom corner. So I'm like, well, you got to pay attention to that. But I try not to get into anybody's business about, like, I'm like, let's, maybe we could fix that. Maybe we could clean it up, but it's your car you're driving. I'm just along for a ride. It's safe. We're fine. So yeah, that jump to definition, and then search in project, like, everybody understanding that. But I feel that like I mentioned in the talk, the advent of order lists is just huge. I did not realize how much I loved it, because I don't have to think about things and can have slightly more forgiving default searches. It's hard. Like, the principles of organizing 10 things versus 100 versus 1,000 versus 10,000 are just, they're not the same.
A common hang up for that would easily make you skip off of Emacs, Org Mode, Hyperbole, is if you go into those, into any of those, with the mindset of I'm going to master it all before I use it, that's not going to work.
Absolutely. I was terrified of Org Mode when I started because I'm like, I don't need to organize my life. I need to like type. And then that, yeah, it's that incremental. What did I find that helpful? It's
huge. Or the Linux CLI toolbox, but you have to look at them as more of just, I have a whole bunch of tools available to me and I'll just pick them up as I have a problem and as the tool can be useful for this problem and incrementally.
Yeah.
But it's
Go ahead.
It's actually so in fact when I'm mentoring people I have to take a step back and say, okay, what the note taking thing that you mentioned in your talk, how do you like to take notes? How do you like to keep track of the things that you want to work on when you have an idea? Where does it go? Because if you improve that practice, and especially if you can sneak some literate programming in without them really noticing, then it becomes the thing that they can use to learn more efficiently.
Yeah. I was presenting at, I wasn't presenting at this work seminar, but I attended it, and it was a crash course in command line tools. And I went there to listen, and there was a point where the people were like, I use this command line tool. I'm not a programmer. I'm a librarian. I'm an archivist. I use it. I'm like, great. I'm going to remember this. And then I forget about it and I might use it 6 months from now. And so I tried to encourage everybody, like, come up with, like, you have a degree in knowledge and information management and organization. Introspect, right? Spend some time on it. Think about what is a way that I can do this and ask questions to get to the point where you can create a discoverable inventory of the tools you've used and what that means. And you know, my answer was, I use literate programming, or I shove it in my bin directory in GitHub, and like, I don't know if I'll remember it, but I can go there every now and then and be like, oh yeah, that command, right? So note-taking is the most critical component of any knowledge work.
Sometimes I wonder, like, if we can maybe externalize some of all this like mentoring insight and kind of like this choose your own adventure thing where the person says, okay, this is what I got at the moment. And then through a series of diagnostic questions, we can figure out what hurts, right? Where is the thing that they would like to learn more about? And then, okay, if that hurts, try this. And to keep that manageable. And if there's only a way to also be able to capture each person's state, the things that they know about and have absorbed into their habits. So that you can say, all right, you know, my recommendation for someone who's brand new to org is not the same as somebody who's like, okay, they've got their agendas and everything set up already. Just how do we represent that as like lisps?
I've given up on trying to map that. I like the one-on-one conversations and discovery. And I think that's the part where you're asking about how do we make the process, and like I heard, like, how do we help equip those who want to mentor as well, right? Making that, reducing the barrier in a way.
I don't know. I think what you said about enjoying the conversation and the fact that it is really unique for each person, each situation that comes up, I suspect what it just comes down to is more like capturing the good stuff of each mentoring session or whatever. Maybe it's getting the mentees to write very short blog posts about what they learned this week or whatever else. Right. And then you say, oh yeah, you know, we ran into the same problem 3 months ago. Let me go look it up. And then that becomes a reusable segment.
Yeah. When I worked at a coding boot camp, they tried to encourage the mentors to say, like, write blog posts for the mentees. And That was, some of them did, but it was intimidating because, like, they didn't want to, I don't know. Are we enculturated in our, in an education system where we can't get it wrong, or we need to look like we're more of an expert than we are? I don't know. I have a lot of, like, I'm a middle-aged white guy. I've got a lot of background and privilege in my like career. So like, it's not as scary to put something forward for myself as it might be as like a woman in tech or a minority in tech. Cause that's a different place. And I want to really get done with that. I don't like that at all. And I would love our, like, just write. And it doesn't have to be public, right? You don't have to make it public, but if you make it discoverable to yourself, that's the big thing. And, you know, one of my coworkers, she doesn't blog, but she definitely has a large knowledge base of stuff that she references because she's pulling out all kinds of stuff. And I'm like, whatever you're doing is working. And
that's great.
So.
I'm trying you to have some.
There's a good opportunity with the Emacs conference to accomplish this. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you make, like, a... Because one of the things with it is you do a... Sasha, you do a really good job of using all the... You're the one who has, like, the Emacs buffer with the time on it, right? Is that your screen that's being recorded for that? Because you have an... really good example of a really consolidated Emacs workflow that works really good with the Emacs conference. So if you had like a page that described how you did all that stuff in the Emacs conference, like on that, and then you did even more stuff with that, like you do the org mode file that you can just put straight into your agenda for your time zone. That's I used that. That was really nice just to, because it allowed me to reorganize and see how all the talks would work together and which ones I wanted to do. You could add org mode to do tags with that to say plan to watch. I want to rewatch, but I have to skip it because there's another talk I'm watching, you know, like a couple tags. Don't care about, so that people can easily tag all the talks that they care about on top of that. And then with I'm going to try to email these ideas on it too, but then you can also, you have the Etherpad questions, you could put all those in org mode documents with crdt.el, post all those in the Emacs conference, and then people could use that to edit all the documents at the same time. So then everybody's actually collaboratively editing. And then people have all the scaffolding for if you do the Emacs meetings, buddy meetings, because they know exactly how to set it all up with that. And then you combine it with any number of whatever chat video program so that people can talk and watch each other.
I have, in fact, I have a presentation later on EmacsConf infrastructure, and I will capture the note, and maybe I can include a mini tutorial in the schedule org so that people can be like, hey, by the way, you could refile these things into your own org files or tag them, and here's a Lisp thingy that filters your agenda by the your tag or whatever. It'll be fun. But it's, you know, it's kind of like, it is, you're right, it is an opportunity to expose people to more things that they could do in kind of a scaffolded way. That's interesting stuff. But your point, actually, Jeremy, also going back to a previous part of the conversation, mm-hmm. about it is difficult for people to share. When you realize, you know, like I keep telling everyone, hey, if you blog about Emacs, you'll not only learn things for yourself and make things more searchable, other people will come by and tell you even better ways of doing things, which yeah. is something that always happens to me too when I'm posting. Does that ever happen? I'm sure that happens to you.
It's great. I love getting those things. Like, Howard's yes. presentation on the game stuff. I'm like, I'm going to go explore that now because That's my wheelhouse.
So. Just have to make it less intimidating, right? And kind of change people's perception that, oh, blogging or sharing tutorials or whatever, that's done when you're an expert, when you're an experienced, to rather working out loud, thinking out loud, this is just that I'm learning along the way. And it might not be the most efficient way to do things, but this is what I've learned right now.
Yeah. So. And I had a handful of times where I posted something and someone was like, oh yeah, have you tried this? Or I'm like, I didn't even know that existed. That makes this easier. Thank you. Right.
A number of times, like I've written this like little hack through, and I'm very proud of it because it's clever. And then someone's like, oh yeah, there's a package for that. It's called this. Like,
right. Great. Yeah. The fantastic part, I played Legos as a kid, and me and my friends would play Legos at the house. And Emacs has this like feeling of playing Legos with a group of people across the world. In fact, one of my best friends now, we met a year ago, and it turns out we both love Emacs. We talk every Thursday and we hang out and we talk poetry. We talk Tom Petty, we talk Emacs, we talk software development. He does Python, I do Ruby, just anything and everything. And it's also, we both are curious because we don't use it the same way. And we like how we accomplish a task. And I think that's the fascinating part to me, is we each get to explore our way to interact with a computer uniquely by whatever pathways are in our brain. We see stuff, we pick it up, and we're like, that doesn't quite work for me, or oh, that worked really well. Fascinating, like I don't know, shared art installation.
I think you're onto something that I also resonate with. One of the things that fascinates me about Emacs is all these people's configuration files, or they're, you know, crystallized workflows. And it's really when you talk to them and you see how they're using it, and you understand a little bit of kind of their story and things that they need, the ideas they've had, that's really fascinating. And I think that's one of the things that makes it possible to be perpetually curious about Emacs, because it's not just the, you know, these are all the Lego pieces there are, but you have this community of people who are using these Lego bricks in such fascinating ways, and they're always inventing new things for it.
Yeah, new colors, new shapes, they show up. It's great.
It's like powered twice or something like that, because it's like, you can use Emacs with 1,000 different customizations, and then you can interact with people who can each also use Emacs in 1,000 different ways.
Right.
And then you can both learn from each other, and that can go 1,000 different ways. So it's like powering or something along those lines with each other, and like how different and how much you can learn from it.
Yeah. The kind of touching back to the mentee that I have, who he had originally started in Vim and then did VS Code. And then we were talking and he was going to go into Emacs, and sure, that'd be great. But he's like, I don't have a lot of time. And I'm like, well, go back to the place that you have that experience. And he did. And then he started writing Lua plugins. He was like, this is so much fun. I'm like, good, you're on the right path. Like, maybe there'll be space, like over time, how Lua plugins and Emacs, you know, who knows? I know that Lua, you can use Fennel to write Lisp. You write Lisp and it will transpile Fennel to Lua. I forget how that plays out, but we're not too far away from those two things being able to play. But I guess, you know, the question is, does it need to? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, even without direct code translation, the cross-pollination of ideas is certainly enough. I love the fact that people are borrowing ideas from VS Code and from Vim, and people look at Emacs Conf videos and other things and say, hey, that's a cool thing in Emacs, but I don't want to ever use Emacs. I'm going to do that whole thing in Vim. And I think that's fantastic.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, monocultures die. They just do. And computer software and computer industry pushes towards monoculture because of it wants the highest efficiency. And I'm like, that I'm not, I mean, sometimes I'm here for that, but most of the time I'm like, I want the bumps and the warts. I want the art, the human interaction, the like, why are we trying to accomplish this?
It depends on how you determine efficiency, because Emacs is far, even if Emacs isn't multi-threaded, it's far more efficient because of the mental model shifts, because you're able to play and tweak with it and then have as much of a mental model shift for each task change that you want. Like, yeah, I want my file manager to not be an editable text buffer. Although sometimes when I want to rename files, I want it to be that.
Right. Yeah. And really, like, to be clear, I like the idea of Emacs as a projection of like how I think about stuff. So it's that whatever my neurons have made a good pathway for, I can have Emacs flow with me. That efficiency side is, I want a factory, I want to stamp out widgets, I want them to be the same, chop, 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 chop. Emacs runs in its spirit along with Vim, contrary to that. And I like that.
Emacs is one of the things with the mental model of Emacs is you should look at Emacs, like, this is probably something that people should think about when they are introducing Emacs to other people, is Emacs is a treasure trove of conflicting ways of solving the same problem, so you can individuate yourself on how you actually want to solve that problem.
Yep.
Do you want Vim bindings or not? You get to choose. Or do you want Meow bindings? You can choose.
Absolutely. Yeah. I lament, because in 2005 I almost picked up Emacs, and it wasn't until 2020 that I picked it up. And fortunately I picked it up when I did, because I was able to look at things I had previously accomplished and find analogs, and things like Helm and Ivy were both two different ways of doing it, and consult and then, or Selectrum and then consult, like they all had these different ways, and it felt great because I could find the thing that worked for me, and they're close, but then they also like branch out and do things differently, and it was so fascinating to explore each of those and spend an hour or two on a primary task and seeing where that little thread went. It's great.
So tell me a bit more about how you got that, how you got into Emacs. What pulled you in?
So yeah, this is a great little moment. I started in TextMate, that's kind of where I would say the beginning for coding for open source and using open source software. Sorry, using open source frameworks and languages. So TextMate to Sublime. Basically, TextMate couldn't search very well at the time. It was getting bogged down. So I moved to Sublime, which solved it, felt well, carried the same like UI look with me. And then when I was at a conference, there was a talk about using an open source editor. And I was like, yeah, I need to do that. I really need to. And Atom was viable. And I was like, oh, this is really close. I'll use it. And I didn't think too much about it. And then the writing was on the wall that Atom is going away. And I was like, I need to find an open source editor that speaks to me. And I said, all right, Vim, this is my fifth time. I will try. And I gave an earnest 2 weeks. And I'm just like, I cannot get this mental model in my head. So I'm like, all right, I set it down. I can use Vim. I'm comfortable. I think it's a great tool, but my mental model doesn't map well there. And I'm like, all right, here we go, VS Code. All right, you're fine, but I feel like I might accidentally charge my credit card in the text editor on the default installation. And that was alluded to by in one of the talks, I forget who, he, German, talked about mandating Emacs in his computer science classes. He mentioned like the Microsoft Office or Microsoft Marketplace felt like it was there. So that was one. But the moment where I was like, oh, hell no, VS Code, was when I tried to type the commit message and I wanted to use a commit from the command palette, and it brought up an HTML text input area, and it was 30 characters. And in that moment, I saw several things. One, I'm like, no, that's terrible because I want to write something meaningful. Two, this is the behavior that this tool is modeling. That tells me that history and like how it is built is not important. And yes, I can fix it and get around it. And I kind of did. And I was like, the principles are just, they're there. And then also understanding like there's a bunch of telemetry underneath it. And that, so I used VS Codeium, but there's still telemetry. And I was like, all right, 2005, Jeremy, let's go try Emacs. Let's see if we can do it. And I hopped in, I grabbed SpaceMax. I was like, yeah, this works pretty well. Like, I don't know how to use the keys very well. I'm figuring it out. And then I was like, you know what? Why don't I do the tutorial? And it was the tutorial that hooked me. Not because everything made 100% sense, because Emacs is old. It had a lot of language that was hard to like internalize, but it presented it in a conversational, I'm going to meet you where you're at, and we're going to walk with it together. And then when I was done with the tutorial, I said, you know, SpaceMax, I don't understand it. And it's got some performance. It looks like there's like extra stuff that I may not need. So I went vanilla, nothing Emacs, and just started working. I was like, well, how do you do this?
Although 5 minutes of SpaceMax or any of those Emacs distribution shows you unequivocally how different it can be.
It was so amazing and it was so good, but I knew my nature was, I was frustrated in like, I wrote an Atom package and that was awful. It was so terrible, but I knew what I wanted. And then I wrote, I started writing a VS Code. I'm like, oh no, we're not here for this. And so, yeah, SpaceMax showed me like this can look and feel like a space that I used to be in. And then it has more functionality, more stuff. It's going to be great. And then I just was like, I'm going to go find my own. And I'm really happy that I took the path because I just worked, wrote, and I'm like, I bet you the tool, I know it can do this because it, you know, TextMate did this or Atom. I went on to Melpa and I found a couple different things. I'm like, all right, let's try them. I'm like, that's the one. Great. Roll it in. Keep working. I know it can do this. Find a package. And so I built up this sense of the packages. And, you know, my strategy was go to Melpa, that was the one that showed up. Look at the number of downloads. So I'm like, what's the high stuff? What really gets used? There's something there. And then also look at what was most recently updated. So kind of pivot on those along with a keyword search. And I found the tools that worked well. But it really came down to like that VS Code I was almost in, but I've been around long enough to know what Microsoft will do.
For me, I always like customizing things. I think I saw some interesting Emacs videos. I wanted to try, I wanted to try working more with the keyboard and not need, I think, the mouse on a laptop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was looking explicitly for like ways to just work on the keyboard only, which meant that I wasn't looking for programs that followed CUA. Which really leaves you like two options, Vim and Emacs.
Yeah.
And when I looked at the two, I saw one of the big differentiating factors I saw was Tramp, which was, oh, you mean I get a SSH into a machine and have my customizations too?
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. And then I started using Emacs more and more. Eventually, I combined that, I think, with Tiling Window Manager, NixOS, and started banishing as much of the GUI as I possibly could, running MPV over VLC so I could edit so that my config files could be keyboard oriented.
Mm-hmm.
My settings config menus are now keyboard oriented. And yeah, that was the incremental process of just, yeah, making the computer nicer, more efficient, and then you figure out all the other advantages of the...
Yeah. How did you get into it, Sasha? Oh,
you're muted.
Your sound is gone.
Sorry. My face is mute button. Okay. I'll tell you that story. I get thought out of my head, so I forget it. But what you described, Jerry, what kind of starting with the distribution and then pulling back and starting with vanilla and building up kind of close to stories that I've heard from a lot of people in the community, where the distribution gives them kind of an angle, at least work requirements, so get their stuff done and they're not slugging through the weeds around the start. I have a hard time modifying it, because modifying the distribution itself is very different from the tutorials they see. They feel like they want to understand the different parts more. And so then they pull back and they say, okay, I've got this thing that I can use. I really need to just get some quick work done. But I have this thing that I can work on that's mine. Right. And that I understand because I'm building it up from the ground up. Okay, so that's like, oh, it's like interesting stuff there. A lot of people are like that. And it really helps them to both have that insight, which is see through distributions and also videos of other people's workflows and press kind of conference presentations, often about completely different topics, right? Just someone whizzing through Ruby on Rails or whatever else and doing all of this in nature. But also having one help them break out, okay, well, there's a lot of work from where I am to where that is. How do I do it without being overwhelmed? Because right. If they start to try to learn everything, they will go crazy and they will fall and whatever. So breaking it down is super important. And how I got into this whole Emacs thing was I was reading all the computer science books in the university library, and one of the Unix Power Tools, that book had a chapter on Emacs and had, you know, well, there's another type of whatever. So I said, okay, that's interesting. So I went and tried it out. But the reason I really got into it was because I was using John Wheatley's Planner Mode. This was before Org Mode came about, so Planner Mode. I said, hey, you know, this is great. I'm looking for a way to help out. If you need help verifying any bugs, you know, send them to me and I'll do the yeah. You know, figuring out. He's the author and maintainer. And then he made me the maintainer for it. So I'm like, okay. And then that's how I got to know this wonderful community of people who guys Emacs so much. And it just goes there because really, when you see all these different ways that people use it and all these different stories that you get a sense of, they're using it to bake sourdough bread and, you know, do knitting and all the crazy things that people come up with. I've been using it as an audio editor, which is weird. It's just fun.
Oh, man. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Cool. Stuff. Every, Sasha, like two things that I was meaning to say is, every time I see the on the Emacs conference the scratch buffer with the big clock that is ticking down and the multiple sized fonts, I always think, wow, that's really cool. I didn't know Emacs could do that. Wait, no, I saw that last year. How do I do that? Because that's not something I normally even think about Emacs doing.
Right.
There's
an emacs-conf-el in the emacs-conf-el repository. I can grab the link and pop in, but you can grab the source code from there. It's basically you add the text property.
Mm-hmm. But it's a thought that that has repeated multiple years, like, I didn't know Emacs could do that. Wait, I thought about that. I had this exact thought last year when I saw it.
Oh, I'm at the point where it's like, I have memories of remembering doing something. I don't have memories of doing it. Like, all of the things. Like, so it's, again, Emacs helps expose, it's anything's possible, and we see how it becomes possible through other people, and then it gets our brains thinking about other ways of doing stuff. And I think that's the exciting part. I have a dog who wants to go play frisbee,
and that's actually one of the reasons why I want to encourage people to not only, you know, talk about Emacs and write Emacs blog posts, but also casually demonstrate Emacs in the sense of doing something else. So, for example, reaching Emacs people at Emacs conference, but if you're presenting about Ruby on Rails and you're doing all of your fancy education and things while you're presenting Rails, you reach all these people who are interested in Rails, develop for Rails, but who might not have even considered Emacs. Here, you know, you probably would. I would probably have a hard time writing an entire talk about adding text properties, but the fact that there's a thing here that shows, hey, this is possible in Emacs, can get people to think, okay, so how do I get from here to there?
Right.
Just showing the possible.
Yeah.
Which source code is in the, whatchamacallit?
Yeah, I just saw that.
I think there's a weird, interesting thing how Emacs dovetails with people who are interested in making their own local first Zettelkasten, because look at how many Zettelkasten packages you have, especially with how much, like, it feels like, it seems like Emacs has more than Vim, but Vim is bigger, or VS, feels like it has more than Vim or VS Code, and VS Code's bigger. I'm not sure, but it feels like it. And same thing with that HyperCourse, where that HyperCourse felt more like a local first peer-to-peer system. So, like, there's a weird dovetail where, like, they want the knowledge bases that are local first, comprehensive, because one of the properties of the Zettelkastens or org mode agendas is that it's all your notes in one place. It's not, you know, your notes in Etherpad and your notes in Google Calendar, your notes in in 20 different places, your notes in Evernote. It's your notes in one program in one place because you have to deal with them, and they're going to be in files on your hard drive, and you're going to have packages that aren't. That's the other weird thing, too, is how many, like, you install an Emacs package, some of the guarantees you seem to get with it is, if it does use an external program, it's going to have a lot of configuration in Emacs.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be installed. it's going to be local first. Because, yeah, like, you have flow bits, but how many programs, like, are cloud first? And it feels like most of those are, like, org Trello, where it's like, I want to use org mode, but other people use Trello, so I'm going to begrudgingly using this org Trello to be a bridge between the two, not because I wanted to use org, not because I wanted to use Trello in the first place, or I started off with Trello and now I want to use org mode.
Right. No, you're that local first. The thought I have is with the 2022 interest rates going up, the era of free money, or even like getting money for more money than it actually costs, like it was minting money. We are going to be seeing how these organizations that had financial runways, all of these cloud services, what's not gonna last because there's no funding. And like the durability of our local first, plain text, free open source stuff. Like, I won't have to do a content migration unless I get a bee in my bonnet and want to like change from org mode to markdown for some reason. Like, I have it and then I can send it out. So there's also like that posse principle, publish on site, syndicate everywhere, is what Emacs and Vim, like, they allow for us to do.
Well, that's part of the individuation, is you have multiple options of doing something, so you can choose something, so you can take ownership of your data in the way you want. Mm-hmm. It all dovetails into each other, and I think that's something worth thinking about, especially in relation with who should learn and how should you introduce Emacs to people, because like with the idea of people should try an Emacs distribution and then start their own from scratch, just so that they, like, if you use it for 10 minutes, you'll gain so much, because you use your three and then all of a sudden you realize you also know how malleable Emacs can be, and then you start saying, now how do I do that so I get to make those choices?
Yeah,
or you might say, this person did it well enough, I don't have to.
That reminded me of something that I also wanted to mention, talking about journalism and malleability. Another tip I came across, don't know from whom, might have been from you, I don't know, it's to define aliases, because we use different words from what the functions are. So it's one of those little meta things that, you know, if you keep calling it something else, just define it so that you can call that commenting your words.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Anyway, I gotta go disappear and get ready for my dog.
Okay,
I'll listen to what you said.
All right, I need to take my dogs out and play frisbee. They have been so patient. So it was great talking with all of you, and Sasha, thanks for the organizing energy you've put into this. Plasma Strike, thank you for your presentation. Like, I love this conference, so thank you very much. And now, have a good rest of your Sunday. Bye.
You are currently the only person in this conference.